Our guest this morning is Baruch Whitehead. Welcome, Baruch.
Well, good morning, Eric.
And you just give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of who you are, some things that we can kind of start this conversation. You're well known in the community in many quarters, but you know, it's this is always, you know, not everybody's paying attention, you know what I mean? Right,
right. Well, I teach at Ithaca College in the music education department. I teach music education classes. I do world music, and I do African drumming and dance.
Uh-huh.
And also have two community choruses that I'm working with at the moment, the Voices Multicultural Chorus, which I've been there, almost 10 years now. And then I just started the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers in about 3 years ago, I think.
Yeah. Right, and they're associated with the Dorothy Cotton Institute, or are they an independent?
We're independent of the Institute, but we, in honor of Dorothy Cotton, many people would know that she worked very closely with Dr. King, and she loves music, and we strive to preserve the nature of the Negro spirituals.
And, yes, and also the language. You can reappropriate language that... meant one thing in one context and another in another and reclaim it. So what we're going to do with the selection of your music, I think we're going to walk through a little bit of your life's journey.
Okay.
And you'd want it, and we'll start with Order My Steps. And what is the name of this, the group that's performing this?
This is the Gospel Music Workshop of America, Women Chorus. And the song was written by a good friend of mine, Glenn Burley.
Okay.
Who passed away suddenly about 3 years ago.
Okay, I didn't, this is the music of a friend. This is a very famous piece, too.
Yes, it's. I've seen marching bands do it. I've seen people in Europe do it. Yeah, it's pretty famous.
There was even a recording of it from Italy and South America. It's been all over the place.
Thank you.
And that was the Gospel Music Workshop of America performing Glenn Burley's Order My Steps. And this is the Made of Clay Mondays, the morning show on Monday mornings. And our guest this morning is Baruch Whitehead. And you were a friend of Glenn Burley's. And want to say a bit about the song and about the man?
Yes, Glenn was a prolific composer of African-American sacred music. He did a great job in bringing the classical world into the gospel arena. And we had a conversation about this song. I said, well, what's this Order My Steps all about? And apparently, of course, I grew up in the South, too, so that was, and I've never seen this, but I've heard about it. The young people would walk down the aisles of the church as some type of a opening event, mm-hmm. if you will, and they would quote scriptures. Mm-hmm. So this idea of Order My Steps grew out of that, experience of him seeing these young people walking down the aisle, quoting these scriptures. So it's a very famous song, and also it lends itself to improvisation. I know mm-hmm. That the solos, when Glenn wrote it, he really didn't write it for a solo verse. It just kind of happens, and
right.
and these types of things, and. The Gospel Music Workshop women got a hold of it, and they kind of made it their own. And then that's the version now that most people do. But the soloist has an opportunity to improvise, which is a very, very big in the gospel music and very, very important.
Right, right, right. But improvisation is not just self-will. It's built on the discipline of...
Well, you have to know what you're doing.
No, you have to know your instrument. You have to know your
absolutely.
Voice.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
And I think something in gospel music, it grows out of one's experience. I don't know if a person can be taught mm-hmm. to sing like that, but certainly I think you can be taught the mechanics of it and the technical part of it. Mm-hmm. But I think that's innate and God-given.
Right. And... It's also an expression of extreme comfort with the music and your body.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in an environment where we would sing conversation. We would make up the melody and the conversation as we worked. And this is there's a long tradition of this both in poor white and black rural America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I kind of grew steeped in. And so when I had to learn how to sing other people's music, it's hard.
Right,
because then you're
right,
self-conscious.
Right.
But when you're unself-conscious, there's a grace and a quality to it that just happens.
And we believe with gospel music too that the Holy Spirit intervenes, and you're taken over by a force that comes from above, a divine intervention.
Yep,
yes.
Yep. So neat, neat. Now tell me, you know, where I come from. When they ask where you're from, they want to know, well, who are you? What sort of a person are you, and where have you traveled through this world to get to where? And this world is both where you've physically been, but also where you've emotionally and intellectually been. Mm-hmm. So, what where have you been, and what brought you to Ithaca?
Well, I grew up in Bossier City, Louisiana, in the Deep South, and I don't really come from a musical background, although my mother did sing and play the piano. And some would say she didn't do it very well, but as I look back...
She was your mother.
She was my mother. So I think I probably got a little bit of what I'm doing now from her. But I remember going to my first football game and was kind of bored with the whole game, but then the halftime came on.
Right.
And I saw the marching band. I thought, wow, that would be really cool to do. So that was kind of my introduction into music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... as that went along, it really afforded me opportunities to travel around the world. And also, it just instilled in me the discipline that I needed to be mm-hmm. successful. And my grandmother was a very, very huge influence on me in terms of getting my education. So she died very, very sudden at an early age. But I still think about her often in terms of really being the person.
Yeah, what was the quality that you of her that you remember that you carry with you?
I think the quality of affirmation. mm-hmm. of who I was and what I wanted to be and what I could become. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have those people in our lives that they're kind of anchors that give us encouragement and give us an opportunity to be more than what we think we can be.
Right, maybe like the image that came to my mind is they're the people that cheer you on in that place deep inside that many people don't even necessarily know, but they go there.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't easy being involved in music in the Deep South because people, you know, little boys didn't do music.
Right.
That was not for boys to do music. So it was very challenging, but I stuck with it, and I'm so glad that I did because a lot of people I grew up with you know, their lives kind of turned to a different direction, and I think there was no time in my life that I thought I would not go to college.
Mm-hmm. The and structure of music,
yeah,
gave you a direction.
It gave me that direction, and a lot of people I grew up with didn't think they could go to college, and they didn't go. So I'm very fortunate mm-hmm. in that aspect of my life. So music has really afforded me. To be able to pull people together and mm-hmm. to understand people. So I go back to my grandmother and the idea of this affirmation of the human spirit mm-hmm. through music.
Yep. Yep. That's neat. And we share kind of a marching band association. I'm one of eight kids, and my two brothers were football players, and I was the drum major.
Okay, okay.
And worked my way up through the percussion section. But yeah, and it really provided a kind of a discipline. And because we were such a small rural area, we had a marching band with only 42 members, and a third of them were in junior high school.
Wow.
And we competed with successfully.
Yeah,
it's because you can do it with music, with the structure.
Absolutely,
yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. So, where did you wander through to get to Ithaca?
Well, I started off in Texas, mm-hmm. In Huntsville, Texas, at Sam Houston State University. Mm-hmm. And I was there a couple years. I played the oboe, so, I guess I was pretty good because people told me I was pretty good. So one day my teacher said...
It doesn't sound like you connected with it quite as much.
Yeah. My teacher said, if you want to play professionally, you really need to go to a conservatory. So at that point, I started looking around at schools and ended up at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, mm-hmm. which was a wonderful experience. A very top-notch school and one of the finest conservatories in the country. And I went back recently, and it's a city of its own. It's really mm-hmm. incredible. But as I went through that program, it kind of taught me that I did not want to do this for mm-hmm. a living,
mm-hmm. sure.
Play the oboe in a symphony orchestra, although I did play for many years professionally. So from that experience, I went to University of Florida, where I did my graduate degree. And then from there, I went to Capella University in Minnesota and did my doctorate. Mm-hmm. But when I was in Cincinnati, I met a wonderful teacher who was my mentor, Renee Boyer White, and she kind of planted in me the seed of doing music at the grassroots level, mm-hmm. and I started to. Develop my interest in the Orff Schulwerk method, which is a way of teaching mm-hmm. Young children music, and I just really fell in love with that, and I really fell in love with making music at the grassroots level. Mm-hmm. And then I put a lot of energy and a lot of time into doing that in terms of my time and energies.
But you're also doing, teaching and now you're teaching in a college program mm-hmm. And you're working mm-hmm. with grad students, I mm-hmm. assume.
Yes, I work with some grad students.
And how do you maintain that commitment to the grassroots
Well, one of the things I do is try to connect to the community. So when I first got here, I went to GIAC mm-hmm. And worked with the young people there. We started the drumming ensemble. We did some music classes. And then from there, I've done countless workshops in the public schools mm-hmm. for all over the place, particularly upstate New York and Ithaca and beyond. And then I worked at Southside. I'm still working there. We have Music Mondays. Mm-hmm. We go and it's really interesting because we don't really go with a plan. We just kind of let the children experience music, mm-hmm. and then we kind of build on that and thinking, well, your ideas are important. So what's your idea about this? And then we'll go with it. And I've also done some work at McCormick Center, at the maximum security facility for juvenile offenders. Mm-hmm. And that's really been very, very rewarding because most of the residents there are African Americans. And it kind of...
It's gone down from 100% to about 75% recently. Yeah. But yeah, it's most...
But then... I thought about that, and why is this? And what I know, everyone makes mistakes in life, but why is it that the people of color tend to be disproportionately incarcerated?
And in one of the toughest facilities the state.
And just the fact that we can go in, and for a little while they can kind of relate to music through the humanity of it all. Mm-hmm. And we have a good time. I really enjoy working with the residents there, and they seem to really respond and enjoy what we bring them.
Yeah, no, and I know they do, and I've seen it. And I've worked there a couple of summers and maintain a relationship with the people bringing in programs, mm-hmm. to McCormick, and mm-hmm. Khalil Bey, the artist, is there too. Some
great.
Tell me, what music should we go to next?
Let's look at The Greatest Love of All.
Okay.
With Whitney Houston's arrangement.
Okie doke. And here we go. I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody's searching for a hero. People need someone to look up to. Never found anyone who fulfilled my needs. A lonely place to be. And so I learned to depend on me. Whitney Houston, The Greatest Love of All. And you're listening to WRFI in Watkins Glen and Ithaca. And our guest on the morning show this today is Baruch Whitehead. And Baruch, tell me a little bit why you picked that song.
Well, one of the reasons I really love Whitney Houston, I think she had one of the greatest voices of the century.
Yeah.
But to go beyond that, I think the message of the song is really, really wonderful in terms of what I do in terms of working with children. Mm-hmm, that and it really makes sense that if we can build strong children, we'll be in good hands. And I think having people learn to work together at an early age is so crucial.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's one song.
And by an early age, what do you mean? Because that keeps getting pushed back younger and younger, you know, to.
Well, I would hope from the womb
on up. No.
Because I think there's a song from a musical, and I can't remember, maybe South Pacific, that you have to learn to hate.
Right, absolutely.
So those kinds of things. And I think about things that are happening in the world now,
right,
today, in terms of particularly people of the Middle Eastern descent, that you know, descendants of people from the Middle East, and how the media has portrayed people. It's
right.
Very, very, very unfortunate. And
I was taking it back even earlier. I work with a voice coach, and one of the things he can see by looking at certain habits or tics or whatever that I have,
mm-hmm.
you can associate them with certain developmental stages of even a toddler or an mm-hmm. infant, mm-hmm. And how you breathe or how you know. I had whooping cough as an infant, and mm-hmm. part of my breathing is messed up by that experience of struggling to actually breathe to survive, and you feel you learn things about yourself, and when you intervene in a child's life really early with a conscious relationship to say you're all right and things are going to be okay, they can be okay,
right.
Just hang
right.
in there with it. That's a powerful, right. powerful thing. So tell me what. You know, what experience has, if there is, is there an experience that's really defined your life, shaped your life, that's kind of helped to kind of push you forward?
I wouldn't say there is one experience. I think I've had many experiences in music, growing up in the South and having to be in both worlds, in the white world and the black world.
Right.
I think you had to pass on some level. Yeah, absolutely. The blacks in the South that my friends thought, well, he thinks he's so great because he's running around with the white kids,
right.
And then the white kids are saying, oh, he's not so bad because he's in music. So I had to learn to navigate these two worlds, which I lived in, all that I existed, because I was like the only black person in the band all of my high school career, and now in the orchestra, certainly that was the case. So even in my college years, there were very few African Americans at that time in music. So I think all of those experiences have really kind of led me to focus on using music as a tool to really understand and to really help people bridge the gaps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the experience is being a different person in different settings.
Yeah.
And having to.
Well, yeah, well, I think we all have different personas.
Oh, yeah. No. And that's, but see, not everybody is articulate about that. We go through life mm-hmm. just assuming that's the way it is, rather than stepping up one level and saying, and as a consequence, I fight this battle or I engage this struggle in this way in one context and in a different way in another context, and yet I'm the same person.
Right.
And in part of kind of growing up, and one of the things that that I want the show about, you know, why it's called The Made of Clay,
right.
It's just about my last name.
Title, yes.
It's that we form from the raw matter and the raw material of positive and negative experiences, something that we claim as our own. And we don't own it, Right. It comes to us by the grandmothers and the parents and the friends and the people who help to shape us, and also who scar us and break us, and things that we need to be resilient from. It's all mixed up in that way. How have you changed over the years?
I've gotten older.
Which means?
In wiser.
Doesn't necessarily follow.
I don't know. I think I look at the world differently. When I first went to Africa to study African drum and dance, and my first experience there was so surreal, because I got off the plane and I saw the faces of my grandmother, my grandfather, my sisters, my brothers. They all looked like me.
And this is in West Africa.
Yeah, West African Ghana. And it was so so surreal. And I just felt like, wow, we really do have a homeland as black people. Mm-hmm. And I think growing up in the South and post-slavery and all those things that people said nothing really great came out of Africa, and believing those lies, I was really, really struck on how beautiful the people were and how kind they were and how they did so much with so very little in terms of their resources. So that really was a defining moment. And now I'm pretty much Afrocentric, you know, in all that I think about and the things that I do. Because I think as we travel through, as we journey through life, I think people who are not black, who don't share these experiences, I think they have a hard time understanding different perspectives, if you will. So I think part of my job is to say, hey, wait a minute, what about this perspective and how would this impact people of color? And people will say, oh, wow, I didn't really think about that. And I think that's why we need to have many people around the table from different ethnic groups, and to be able to make a sound decision that would really positively affect everybody.
Right. Right, right, and what I hear in your reaction to arriving, is to in America, because of our affluence, we tend to do a little with a lot.
Right.
But in other places where they don't have the affluence, they can do a lot with a little, because they know how to work relationships.
Absolutely.
And leverage what few resources you have, and the. Affluence has really, really damaged a lot of our ability to deal with making something just between us in a relationship across differences. We need those skills the most right now, but they are often embedded in our roots, which come from more traditional culture, whether you're white or black or Native American or Asian or whatever, than in modernity, which is built on stuff. And it does not feed us.
Yeah, you're right.
It does not feed us. So one of my where I have to pass is they see people see this white guy, this old white guy now, and he's kind of pushy. And has an Ivy League education, and the assumption is privilege. And well, yes, I am now by a lot of standards, but that's not what I come from. And it's when you live in multiple worlds, you have to take multiple perspectives, and making people aware that you've just entered a different space. We may share the same color or even the same geographic residence, but you move from one household or one congregation or one community, and you're in a different space if you really want to connect with folk.
That's beautiful. That's absolutely right. I think we all need that, and to be able to process that. And I think people are just unaware of these kinds of issues. And that's why I go back to this idea of having many people around the table to be able to make a decision. I remember once when I was at a conference in Alabama, in Birmingham, of all places. And I actually got the chance to go to the Civil Rights Museum and the 16th Street Church, where the bombing had taken place many years ago. And I know these people in my association, and they're not, I would not call them racist or prejudice or anything like that. I guess we all have prejudices, but they brought all these kids in, and Birmingham is like 75% African American. So they went into the suburbs and brought, and there were very, very few African American young people performing, which I really thought was just tragic. And then they sang this song, "Jump Down, Turn Around, Pick a Bell of Cotton." And I challenged them on that. I'd say, you know, my grandmother was telling me how she picked cotton. It really wasn't a good thing. And it was very, very, how she was mistreated. And it was very, very difficult. It tore up your hands and your fingers. And it was a very, very horrible experience, if you will. So no one at that table thought to say, is this the best song be presenting to the public? And that was the year that Rosa Parks had just died. And I thought it would have been beautiful for us to sing We Shall Overcome, Holding Hands, those kinds of things. So I just think sometimes people need to think outside of their comfort zone and outside of the box and just say, I don't really know, help me. So whenever I'm doing other people's music, if you will, I try to get a person from that culture to come in to explain to us the music and why the music is the way it is and how it's put together. And even when I teach African drumming and dance at Ithaca College, we really take time to understand why this music is the way it is. And I tell the students, this is not some exotic adventure that you're going on. This is something that you can take pride in, and also something that you can learn from. You can learn from people in Africa.
Yeah, and I guess what the question, I want to take this even a couple of notches down deeper if we can.
Okay.
And how do you take people from like the tourist grade appreciation of the other to through music or through drumming, singing, how do you take it down to the level where you can begin to feel the tones and the weariness and the hope and the joy and the kind of explosive glee that comes in music that is performed spontaneously without self-consciousness, as you were saying, with the spirit in the gospel tradition. How do you get people to assimilate into the other's experience in that way?
Well, one of the things I do with the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers is really give the backstories behind the spirituals. You know, a lot of those spirituals were coded messages for the slaves to be able to escape or to do to put courage into them, if you will. And I think we could just simply come and rehearse and try to get the notes as perfectly as possible and not have a connection to the music. So I think culturally you have to be connected to the music. Mm-hmm. And I think and sometimes that takes time to be able to do that. And I look back on my experiences in the South. And I think when I used to get up in the morning, and I'm an early morning person, that's why I chose the 7 o'clock time to come into. But I would go get up, and my grandmother would have these spirituals on, the radio on, and they would have gospel music and spirituals. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, oh, that was just her and her day, and da-da-da-da.
And that was another day. Yeah, that was another time.
But as I got older, I reflected on those and say, wow. And I think, 12 Years a Slave won the Academy Award for Best Picture last night. Mm-hmm. And I, the music in that, it was like the Phil songs. And I thought, wow, I connected to that. Number one, it's a powerful movie. That was one of the movies that I just afterwards, I couldn't speak. I just sat there for maybe 5 or 6 minutes to kind of absorb the whole thing. But getting the backstories, why was music so important for the slaves to be able to sing? I think it made the day go a little shorter, and it just made their lives a little bit easier in terms of what they had to endure. Because none of the slave songs talk about retribution or hurting. It was always God would make this right. At some point, God would intervene.
That this is
and
wrong,
help us,
and it's going to be made right.
Right. Even if it's not in this life.
Right.
So I am the hope of the slave. I think they could not imagine a black man being in the White House. They could not imagine blacks and whites going to school together.
The these conservatory kinds of things. In yes. Cincinnati, yes. The, you know, the career teaching at Ithaca. That's, I mean, I think one of the things that, and this may be my prejudice, Ithaca has a wonderful music scene, but it's a lot of self-conscious performance.
Mm-hmm.
And what I long for are people who break into song spontaneously mm-hmm. in their homes, mm-hmm. or where you're not ashamed to share the voice you got, whether right. it's in speech or in music. Right. And growing up in an all white rural area, we knew we were all right when we could start singing.
Right.
When we couldn't sing, things had us down. And they had we were under the weight of stuff that we couldn't figure out a way out of. But once we found a way, we would start singing.
All right, that's beautiful. I think it's just not only in Ithaca. I think the culture in the U.S. is to be consumers of music and not makers of music.
Yes.
So you know, part of my job, I think, is to help people make music and not just to consume it.
Amen.
So.
Do we want to go to Bobby McFerrin or The Man in the Mirror? Where do you want to head next?
Time is getting short.
We've got time for all the songs. We'll just
okay. Let's go to Man in the Mirror.
Okay. Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror. There's kind of a long lead in this particular one.
It's gonna feel real good. Gonna make a difference. Gonna make it right. As I turn up the collarbone, my favorite winter coat, this wind is blowing my mind. I see the kids in the street with not enough to eat. Who am I to be blind, pretending not to see them need? A summer's disregard, a broken bottle top, and a one-man show. They follow each other on the wind, you know, 'cause they got nowhere to go. That's why no one yet to know. I'm starting with me. I'm starting.
And that was Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and we are talking with Baruch Whitehead, and this is Made of Clay Mondays. Baruch, one of the things I like to get people to talk about, if there is something, how has what you've discovered in life been different than you thought it was going to be? You know, what was it that you were kind of, how you built your life, or you convinced was going to be, and how have things been different than you thought they were going to be?
I think for me, at an early age, this idea, if you do the right thing, then everything would turn out to be right. And I think that's not always the case in personal relationships, you know, or if you say the right things and people would just do what they needed to do to make life a little easier. And I find that those kinds of things are kind of immature thinking, because I think you have to think beyond that, to be empathetic. And even if a person is treating you badly, first of all, I was thinking that that person was really having a hard day, blah, 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 blah. But I think for me to step back and say, why is the person that way? And try to get the backstory, you know, why did you say that? I mean, why, you know, this is the way I heard, this is what I heard you say and how that affected me. So I think being able to open up communications with people and not just letting things ride and letting resentments build. So those kinds of things, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And I think you said something that's even, you said it gently. my role in life is a level of bluntness that may or may not be helpful, but when you are hurt, don't make it a capital case, but just say, hey, that hit me in a wrong sort of way, and I'm wondering what's going on with you, and I'm not hold it against you. But I'm also not going to forget about it, because we need let's talk,
right? And open that communication.
Yeah, and that's scary.
Right. And life is not a formula. If you do A, then you're going to get B. I mean, I think there's a lot of ingredients that goes into one's life and how you process that and how you let things affect you mentally, spiritually. So those kinds of things, I think, in my life now, I'm really trying to understand and really trying to process that. I think we're all looking for affirmation. I think the being affirmed,
validation,
yes, absolutely. You know, high five. I mean, that those kinds of things. And I think when we don't have those, then we really suffer. We suffer silently sometimes. We don't want to let people know what's going on. I went to this past weekend. I was in Texas, which was incredible. It was 80 degrees there in San Antonio. But my aunt had she was very ill. A while back, and her daughter gave her a surprise birthday party, but her church community came through, and it was such a beautiful outpouring of love and respect and affirmation. And I thought, wow, this is just something that people often experience when they're dead and gone. But I was so happy that she had that experience. And my grandmother used to sing this song. It was called Give Me My Flower. It goes, give me my flower while I yet live, so that I can smell the beauty that they bring. That was really a beautiful experience.
Wow. When my mother was dying of brain cancer, she was open with everybody in the community what was going on, and we seven siblings, we actually came back and we took turns living with her a week at a time so she could stay at home. not have to be in a hospital or hospice. She was in hospice, but it was at home. Mm-hmm. And the church choir would come and rehearse in our living room.
Wow.
So that she could be part of that when she couldn't go out. And then we would gather and we would sing, and people would come in, and we would recreate the quartets and the things that we had been as children growing up, only we were gray and older or whatever at this point. But yeah, that's exactly right. And the impact is on the whole community.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
you picked a Bobby McFerrin tune.
Yes.
This is one of the most upbeat pieces of music that I've heard. And I don't see a contradiction between what you just said about going to the darker, going to the harder places. Color and race is written into our language in ways that are not necessarily helpful, but to go to the awkward place. But there's also this other side, which is just let it go. And it's not a bad side. Did you want to? So let's.
You have
go,
to.
Yeah. You have to, or you.
You go crazy.
You go crazy, or in effect, die.
Right.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry. Be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate. Don't worry. Be happy.
Look at me, I'm happy. Don't worry. Be happy. I give you my phone number. When you worry, call me. I make you happy.
Don't worry. Be happy. Ain't got no cash, ain't got no style, ain't got no gal to make you smile. But don't worry. Be happy. When you worry, your face will frown, and that will bring everybody down. So don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, don't worry, don't do it. Be happy. Put a smile on your face. Don't bring everybody down like this. Don't worry. It will soon pass, whatever it is. Don't worry, be happy.
not worried. I'm happy.
Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy. And our guest is Baruch Whitehead. So, Baruch, one of the things that I like to focus on the last segment of the show is to get people to talk kind of explicitly, what do you do on a daily basis or on a regular basis to try to do an attitude adjustment or you know, maintain, you know, get back in touch with your optimism, your strength? What do you do physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually to kind of keep yourself running in good order?
Well, one of the things I do every morning is I thank God for being able to get up and get dressed and be in my right mind, because I think having good health is so important to one's being mm-hmm. and existing, and be able to connect to the higher power, if you will. For some people, it's Allah. So for some people, it's Buddha. For some people, it's Jesus. So whatever it is for you, to be able to take time to be appreciative.
Right. And what you're saying is that gratitude is the connection to that which is beyond yourself.
It changes you. Yeah. If you're grateful, and I know that when I travel to a third world country, in particular Ghana, people are so grateful that, number one, that I came and came to Africa or back to Africa, and they're so grateful that we have these experiences. We talk. I mm-hmm. said, what are your hopes? What are your dreams? Mm-hmm. And when your dreams become my dreams and your tears become my tears and your happiness, we all can rejoice. And I think we make that human connection.
Yep.
And I think through music, it has really afforded me a way to bring people together mm-hmm. opposed mm-hmm. to pulling people apart. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things that I strive for and think about constantly. Oh, how am I affecting other people? Because
so you're restoring yourself by becoming clearer about how am I a connecting link? How is what I'm doing
right,
working?
Right. Because if you don't fix yourself, if you can't, mm-hmm. what do I have to give if I'm not healthy?
Right. So the flip side of gratitude is giving.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I think if we can just give, and it may be just saying good morning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure, sure. Sure. It's a habit of thought.
Mm-hmm.
It's about thinking about making an inventory of what you're grateful for, mm-hmm. knowing what you have to offer others, and an attitude of emotional optimism and joy. How do you cultivate that latter? Well, you did, but the gratitude piece. How do you physically keep yourself healthy?
Well, you try to eat right. Which
don't
always happen mm-hmm. in a busy lifestyle.
Sure.
But, you know, I just think we need to think about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And not just to get up and go, oh, I got to go this, I got to do this, I'm so busy, da-da-da. And I often hear my students say, oh, I'm so busy. I'm saying, well, have you ever stood at the foot of the bridge and look at the beautiful scenery that's on this campus?
Yep.
Have you thought to say to the flowers, wow, that is really gorgeous?
Right.
So I think we just tend to think about the negative things. And somehow they take pride in this idea of being so busy that they can't really be appreciative, which I think is really sad.
Right, right, right. That is incredibly sad. I have been a creature of that culture. Burned through two marriages in large part because I, whenever things were not going well, I was just working. And my kids' memory of me is that they didn't feel comfortable in interrupting me because dad's busy working on his various projects, which oftentimes was connecting people when I was disconnected from those closest to me.
Wow.
And what I've done for the last 4 months is take an hour or 2 hours every night to do nothing. And on many levels, this is the busiest time in my life. And yet it's the only time I have ever said to myself at the end of the day, you are going to do nothing with someone you care about and do nothing.
Oh,
and,
that's beautiful.
And it's,
Right. I remember an experience when I go to Africa. we leave all cell phones and computers sure. and all the, and it's really interesting because we kind of get up with the sun and we go to bed with the sun, and that's mm-hmm, how people mm-hmm. operate.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of a freeing thing. And I tell the students who I take often to Africa from Ithaca College, leave all that behind. We'll buy a phone so you can check in with your parents, but you need to experience life as the Africans mm-hmm. experience life.
As close as you can get.
As close as you can get, because you'll never be African. I'll never be African, yeah. but the idea of connecting to a human on these levels are so, so important. And those students, they leave there, they're changed people, and they look at themselves in a global perspective, mm-hmm. from a global perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest today has been Baruch Whitehead. Baruch, it has been wonderful to have you on the show. And we're about to cut into Heal the World, which is just kind of where this whole thing is led up to.
Yes.
Do you want to say something about this as your closing comments?
Listen to the lyrics. I think we can do it.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place in your heart, and I know that it is love. And this place is much brighter than tomorrow. And if you really try, you'll find there's no need to cry. In this place, you feel there's no hurt or sorrow. There are ways to get there if you care enough for the living. Make a little space, make a better place, heal the world, make it a better place. Strong and only cares for joyful giving. If we try, we shall see. In this bliss we cannot feel, there are dreams to stop existing and start living. Then it feels that always love's enough, hope is growing.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, W201CD, Lansing.